Okay, thanks. I apologize for adding one more talk to this day, which is full of talks, not least for me. And I also, I don't know if there's any overlap with the, I gave a Blackboard talk earlier this week, and I was trying to think about how to do it so people could still get something out of it and not have complete overlap. I have tried to arrange this so that there will be some overlap with the Blackboard talk, but what I did with the Blackboard talk was not have it explain anything with pictures, and here I'm going to explain things with pictures. So there'll be, so what overlaps will be non-overlapping. In any case, I come here from Cleveland to Santa Barbara to depress you. So here's the outline of the talk. The first part of the talk, I want to describe how we probably live in the worst of all possible universes to live in. That the future is indeed miserable. So that will be, you know, that will be the beginning of the depression, but then I want to give you a moment of hope. And so the second part of the talk is I'd like to prove that even though, that we cannot prove we live in the worst of all possible universes. Okay? And so, in fact, we'll never be able to prove that fact. So that should give some hope. But then I'll point out that all hope is dashed, that our, independent of our ignorance of cosmology, in fact, there is no future for life. Independent of our ignorance for cosmology, which I think is an interesting statement, and I hope that you will find it interesting, if not informative. And then I'll conclude with something I call a cosmic uncertainty principle, and the key question for the future of life, which I'll describe, on whether life is analog or digital. Okay, so this is the short version of the talk, and which is one of my favorite quotes that came from a commencement address at a private girls' school, where the speaker began by saying, "Things are going to get unimaginably worse, and they're never ever going to get better again." This appropriately describes the universe. But I did want to, for those who weren't at the at my Blackboard lunch, give you a quick review on the universe as we believe it now is. So the first thing about the universe is it's flat, and I just want to remind you of how, for the 20th century, most of the 20th century, the way we tried to figure whether the universe was flat was by solving Einstein's equations, knowing Einstein's equations and then trying to measure the different pieces of Einstein's equation in the universe, namely measure the expansion rate of the universe and the energy density of the universe and seeing if there's anything left over. And if there's nothing left over, the universe is flat. If there's something left over, the universe is either open or closed. And this was really the business of cosmology for much of the 20th century. The problem, of course, is that this, after 70 years, is now known to maybe 10%, and if some people would argue not even that, but maybe 10%, we can measure the Hubble constant with great effort and great cost. But that's the easy part. This part, measuring the mass density, is much harder because, in principle, you can't see the mass. You can see the light, and so you have to make huge inferences. So the idea was to take two poorly measured quantities and compare them and see if there's anything left over. And that's really what cosmology was about in the last 30 years. And that's also the reason why you could come up with virtually any result, because the quantities are measured so poorly that anything was possible. And you saw many articles on open, closed, and flat universes. And as I mentioned in my Blackboard talk, but not with pictures, which I'll do, we don't have to do that anymore. We can now measure the geometry of the universe directly. And I'll do this quickly. Was there anyone who wasn't at the Blackboard talk? Because maybe I can just, okay. Just to briefly remind you, when we look at the cosmic microwave background at the surface of last scattering, which is located roughly 10 billion light years away, there's one particular scale that is important. And that's the scale over which light could travel at the time this microwave background radiation was created, when the universe was 3,000 degrees in temperature, at a time of roughly 300,000 years. And that's 300,000 light years across. That separates regions where microphysics can respond to gravity from regions where microphysics can't respond to gravity by causality. And if you do the calculation, you'll find out the size of this region, this 300,000 light years on this surface, is roughly of order 1 degree of scale on the sky. That gives us, in principle, a ruler which allows us to measure the curvature of the universe, because it's only 1 degree on the sky if the universe is flat, because in open universes, light rays diverge as you go back in time, and in closed universes, they converge as you go back in time. So a fixed length will span different angular sizes depending upon the universe. And it's true for two-dimensional curved universes as well as three-dimensional ones. The picture works there. And so the idea is to see whether it's really 1 degree and look at the cosmic microwave background and look for that characteristic signature. Now, I couldn't show you the pictures last time, but I will this time. This is the COBE picture, which shows it temperature variations in the sky. First, if you measure on the scale of degrees, there are no such variations. But if you expand the plot down, up, show so that you can see temperature variations of order microkelvin, I should say, of order 1 part in a million or 10 parts in a million, you begin to see temperature variations in the sky, which is that on that surface of last scattering, 10 billion light years away in all directions. And those are the variations one wants to look at in principle. The problem is, on this scale, these lumps are much, much bigger than 1 degree across. The reason is that the COBE instrument had an effective resolution of 10 degrees, and so you only see fluctuations on scale 10 degrees and larger. So you want to do better. You want to look at small scales, and a number of experiments have done that recently. This is my favorite because it's the boomerang experiment where the PI is now at Case Western Reserve University, moved recently from West Coast University. The boomerang experiment sent a microwave radiometer around the world at in Antarctica and looked at a small patch of the sky with a temperature resolution and an angular resolution that in principle could measure these lumps. And this is what they saw and superimposed on their image here. This is their specific picture. In particular, if you then try and do a Monte Carlo and ask how big the lumps should be that are of order horizon size at the time that surface was created in a closed universe, you see that the angular scale they span is bigger because light rays converge. And if you're careful and you look carefully, you'll see that the average lump here is smaller than the average lump there for an open universe. But just like Goldilocks, it's just right for a flat universe. And of course, the power spectra that you see here often demonstrate this, that the power is of order a degree scale, which is what you expect for a flat universe. And this is the most recent data set, or one of the most recent. There's probably some more, in fact, added on to this. But the position of this peak tells us, in a largely model-independent way, that we live in a flat universe. Okay, and the other thing I pointed out, however, was that while the universe is flat, it's dominated by other stuff. And I argued for different reasons that I'll show today that the way we know that is that we know the matter density is less than the total density. And this is one way to measure the matter that I didn't talk about yesterday or on Monday, so I'll show it here. It's a beautiful way to weigh the largest structures in the universe. This is a cluster of galaxies, and this uses gravitational lensing, which was predicted by Einstein in 1937, I think. But the fact that objects well behind a cluster of mass we'll have multiple images produced as the light traverses the mass and distribution is bent. And because we have general relativity, we can, in principle, invert this image to determine the mass distribution. And here is the mass distribution that would produce that image. And from these kind of images, one can try and weigh the largest structures in the universe. And they agree precisely with the evidence that I talked about in the Blackboard talk on Monday. When you weigh these large clusters, you find out their mass is such that the mass density of the universe is only 30% of the closure density, okay? Definitively, at large, you couldn't get to a flat universe within many sigma from that. Now, the other evidence, which I mentioned, but I'll show the pictures today, come, of course, from the much more publicized result that the universe is accelerating. That type 1a supernovae both occur with great frequency in the universe, very low frequency per galaxy, but great frequency per many galaxies because the universe is big and you just have to look at many galaxies. Even though these explode once per 100 years or so per galaxy, if you look at enough galaxies on a given night, you're bound to see one, which is what's done. And you can see that when they explode, they're as bright as a whole galaxy, sometimes brighter. Here's one that you couldn't, where there's no, the host galaxy isn't even visible in this image. And the thing that I also didn't mention on Monday, by trying to compare the distance of these objects to their redshift, one can try and determine the rate at which the universe is accelerating as a function of time. And one can find their distance by using the fact that they're standard candles. And the reason they're standard candles is this phenomenological plot, which is of profound importance for this field. It's phenomenological in the sense that no one has a theoretical model that predicts this behavior. people are not even certain exactly what the precursors are of type 1a supernovae. But phenomenologically, if you look at nearby supernovae whose distance you can measure by other means, you find out that if you measure the brightness of these things as a function of time, there appears to be a rather good phenomenological fit, namely, the brighter ones last longer. And it's a one-parameter fit, so that you can scale, if you scale all of these curves in height by some multiple of their width, they all reproduce the same curve. So that phenomenologically, they appear to be standard candles in the sense that if you measure the length of time one of these supernovas is bright, you know its intrinsic luminosity. And if you know its intrinsic luminosity, how bright it is, you know how far away it is. So that's how these things have been used to derive the curve that everyone has seen before in many places, that if you measure the distance versus redshift, you find out that it, for a universe that's decelerating as it should be if it was dominated by normal matter, in fact, our universe appears to be doing the opposite. Most of these points are above this line, which suggests that the universe is accelerating. The only thing that can make a universe accelerate is vacuum energy density or something very much like vacuum energy density. And from this plot, the fit here, you see that if 30% of the universe is matter and 70% is vacuum energy density, you get some rough fit. So that reviews the universe as we know it to be, or we believe it to be, and tries to quickly summarize some of the stuff I talked about on Monday. Okay, so having said that, I will be quoting from a variety of philosophers. I quoted first from an ancient one. This is a less ancient one. As Yogi Berra said, the future ain't what it used to be. And this is dramatically true. Now that we understand the universe, so I will take for the moment the supposition that we live in a universe that's dominated by vacuum energy density, by a cosmological constant. And that changes everything. That changes everything because it makes the universe we live in the worst possible universe to live in on two different realms, as far as the quality of life and quantity of life is concerned. And I'm going to talk about both. First, I want to talk about quality of life. And in this sense, I take a view different than Washington. I take the view that an unexamined life is not worth living. So I view no knowledge as no quality. And I will point out the longer we wait, the less we will know about the universe. The first person to argue this was George Orwell, who said, to see what is in front of one's nose requires a constant struggle. This is what he meant by this. In a universe dominated by a cosmological constant, the energy density quickly goes to a constant. And if you solve Einstein's equations for a constant energy density, you find out the universe expands exponentially. This can be rewritten as the Hubble law, which says that the velocity of objects is indeed proportional to their distance away from us, but unlike every other universe where the Hubble constant is not constant, in this universe the Hubble constant is constant, related to the vacuum energy density, and that means literally the further away an object is, the faster it is moving away from us, and that also means that objects beyond a certain fixed distance will have a velocity away from us faster than the speed of light. That is certainly allowed in general relativity, there's no problem with that, but what it means is when such objects are indeed moving away from us faster than the speed of light, they are no longer visible, because the light they emit cannot catch up with the fact that they're being carried away by space. So what that means is that objects greater than some distance, which one can calculate, are now receding faster than the speed of light from us, and they always will be. And one can do the calculation and ask what that distance is. And the surprising thing, perhaps, maybe not surprising, depending upon how you think about it, if you plug the energy density of empty space in, the energy density we think is the 70% of the closure density, into these equations, you find out that the horizon size, the distance out to which you can see in principle, namely the distance beyond which objects are moving away faster than the speed of light, is not very far, it should be gigalight year, I'm sorry, is not very far away from us. 18 gigalight years away from us, which is certainly comparable to the very close to the size of the observable universe now. So these effects should, in fact, soon become extremely visible. They're already beginning to be visible. What will happen, of course, is not that we will see objects. In fact, we can wait forever and we'll never see an object past this horizon. What we'll see is that as the objects get close to the horizon, the redshift, the light emitted by those objects, will increase exponentially and eventually become infinite, but before they leave the horizon. So as the universe expands exponentially, the light redshifts, and then one can ask, okay, how much will the light redshift? Well, you say, well, how long will it take before objects outside of our local supercluster have reached this scale? Because if we assume for the moment that our local supercluster is bound, then it doesn't expand with the background expansion, but everything outside of the supercluster does expand with the background expansion and is moving away from us eventually exponentially. And we can calculate how long it will take. Well, the difference between the supercluster scale and this horizon size scale turns out to be a factor of 5,000. Relating that to an exponential, if the universe is expanding exponentially, one can calculate the time it will take for all such objects to reach this distance, and that'll be about 150 giga-years. So 150 billion years, which may seem like a long time to the condensed matter physicists in the audience, but in fact, it's just a blink in a cosmic eye.
It's not a blink, if you think of the age of the universe.
Well, I mean, it's long compared to it's 10 times the present age of the universe or so, but it is a time that is perfectly reasonable to think about in the sense, I don't know if Polchinski's here, in the sense that stars like the kind, that astronomers just like us could be alive then. Lifetime of main sequence stars exceeds this time. You can imagine planets and life powered by solar power that lives and astronomers that work at this time. But at this time, the redshift for all objects outside of our local supercluster will exceed a factor of 5,000. So that means the visible light from these things will have redshifted. Of course, they could still be visible because the ultraviolet light or the extreme ultraviolet light could be redshifted into the visible region. But the great thing about an exponential is it's an exponential. And you don't have to wait much longer before things get even more miserable. In 2 trillion years, which is, by the way, comparable to the lifetime of the longest-lived stars in the main sequence. So again, could imagine, you don't have to be a science fiction writer to imagine life like us living at that time. The redshift of all objects outside of our local supercluster will now exceed 10 to the 53. And that means even the highest energy cosmic rays that we now know of in the universe today will have their wavelength redshifted to being basically larger than the horizon. And they will be invisible. So nothing, zero information, will come from any object outside of our local supercluster at that point. And astronomers at that time will not have any knowledge of what is going on in the universe outside of our local supercluster. They will have no knowledge of the evolution of the universe, or no empirical knowledge. The rest of the universe will at that point have literally disappeared. And well before then, most of it will have begun to disappear. In fact, some of it has already begun to disappear now. You can show that if the vacuum energy over the total energy is greater than 0.7, and it's around that number now, then the in principle observable region of the universe has already been shrinking since the universe was half its present age. So there's already information we have lost that had we been around earlier, we would have been able to know. There's stuff we'll never know empirically for those people that are worried about empirical knowledge. And in fact, so that's the bad news. The good news I've tried to turn this around and argue that we only have a limited amount of time to observe things. And so I've tried to argue to Congress, in fact, they should fund cosmology now. The problem is that the definition of long-term future for a physicist and for a congressperson is very different. Their long-term future is 2 years. And so it hasn't yet resonated. But in principle, if we don't do it now, we'll never be able to do it. So that's the... That's the bad news, as far as the sort of quality of life is concerned. The rest, in the astronomers of the future, will be ignorant.
Here's another stupid question here.
What's
the time that this whole supercluster, our supercluster, is extinguished because all the mass will just,
A time very long compared to this. Okay, we'll go into that. Don't worry. These times are short compared to where we're heading. But first, I want to take a little respite and point out. That it's really, so that's the, that is, this is like Charles Dickens. That's the future as it might be. But we don't know if it's the future. Because we're not sure we live in a universe dominated by a cosmological constant. And in fact, I want to point out that we will never know. Not only now, but I will argue we will never, ever know, unless we have a theory of everything, whether we live in the worst of all possible universes. We will never empirically be able to determine the future of the universe. Which is significant. I mean, one of the reasons I went into cosmology was precisely because I thought that would be determinable when we knew the geometry of the universe, because Einstein told us geometry was destiny. Geometry isn't destiny. Geometry is irrelevant. That's one of the things we've learned in the last 2 years. So let me remind you of that, and since this is the KITP, I've decided to show something I wouldn't show in a colloquium elsewhere. I want to just remind you of the graduate level proof that geometry is destiny. Okay? I'll take 5 minutes. Here are Einstein's equations. First order, second order Einstein's equations for an expanding universe relating the expansion rate to the energy, the rate of change of the expansion rate to the equation of state parameter, which we talked about on Monday, and the fact that the energy density of each species redshifts. Now, for all normal objects, matter and radiation, the energy density and pressure satisfy the following constraints. The strong energy condition, that rho times 1 plus 3w is greater than 0, and that rho is greater than 0. Okay? Now, that immediately tells us, if we plug this into this, it tells us that the universe decelerates. Okay? Then, if we use that result, plus the fact that the energy density is greater than or equal to 0, then one can show by bringing this over to this equation over to here, this side of the equation over to here, that if k is less than 0, then h squared is always greater than 0 forever. It never goes to 0. And that is the statement simply that if we live in an open universe, the expansion rate continues forever. If it's expanding now and it's open, the expansion rate continues forever. Similarly, if you use this equation and plug it in here, you can prove to yourself fairly simply that the energy density of everything sensible always has to redshift faster than r to the minus 2. And if you plug that in here, then if k is greater than 0, you can prove, because this term will redshift faster than this term, if k is greater than 0, then you always get a turning point where h equals 0, and this is always negative. So the universe must collapse. So that's the graduate level proof that a closed universe must collapse and an open universe will expand forever. Now, of course, we understand that that proof is irrelevant, because vacuum energy violates the strong energy condition. I wrote down the form of it at the blackboard lunch, but that's the form of vacuum energy density by Lorentz invariance. And that changes this equation to this equation, where this term doesn't redshift. And the implication of that is that now absolutely anything is possible, independent of geometry. Geometry, as I say, is completely irrelevant. And let me go through that explicitly. The new rule is that there are no rules for the expanding universe. If the expansion rate is greater than 0, when vacuum energy begins to dominate, it will remain greater than 0 forever, independent of whether the universe is open or closed. So a closed universe can expand forever. It doesn't matter anymore. Now you might say, well, let me not believe the present observations. Let's say the present observations are incorrect. There isn't any vacuum energy dominating empty space. After all, it's astrophysics. Okay? So it's wrong. So, and in fact, let's say the universe is closed in that case. If there's no vacuum energy density and the universe is closed, we know it must be collapse. Right? But, do we really know that? Well, we know that, in fact, if a universe is going to recollapse, its maximum size over its size today is given by this, where this is omega today. So observations from the CMB, for example, suggest that omega total is less than 1.1 today. That tells us that the universe will expand until it's at least 11 times larger than it is today. Okay? If it's going to collapse. But normal energy density falls as 1 over r cubed. If the universe expands to 11 times its size today, the energy density of normal matter will be 1/1000th, less than 1/1000th of its present density. So there could be a vacuum energy density which is 1,000 times smaller than the one we claim to measure now. It's completely unobservable, okay? But it will stop the universe from turning around on a time well before it would turn around if we're closed. So we might not measure vacuum energy today, but there's no way we can rule out a vacuum energy density that's 1,000 times smaller. So no observation could tell us, even if we live in a closed universe and the present vacuum energy density we measure is not there, can't tell us that there isn't one that will stop the collapse. Now you may say, what if the universe is opened and the present observation is incorrect? Don't we expand forever? The answer, of course, is no, because we don't know anything about the nature of the vacuum energy density. The ultimate vacuum energy density, some people who do string theory might argue that the ultimate vacuum energy density in the universe is negative. Okay? Live in anti-de Sitter space. And in that case, The energy density of everything we know of will redshift away, and whatever this vacuum energy density, even if it's a e to the minus 1,000, if it's no matter how small its magnitude is, it will eventually dominate the energy density of the universe, causing the universe to recollapse. So even if the universe is open, there could be a small negative vacuum energy density that could change all of the equations ultimately in the long-term future. Now you might say, what if the present observation is correct? Are we therefore sure the universe will expand forever? And as we spent a lot of time talking about on Monday, no, because no one knows if what we're seeing is truly vacuum energy density. It could be just something that looks like vacuum energy density, but it's eventually going to go away. Dark energy that has some equation of state that changes with time. Right now it looks like vacuum energy density. And so in fact, Mike Turner and I argued a few years ago that no finite set of observations, if you take all this into account, at any finite time in the universe are good enough to tell you the ultimate future. The only way to know the future is to know what the vacuum, what it is that's dominating the energy density. No, theoretically. But if you just work empirically and say we'd like to learn the future based on what we measure from cosmology, the answer is we'll never know the future. We'll never know without a theory of everything. And so whether you believe or not that we'll get one depends upon, you know, the answer to whether we'll know the future depends upon that. Well, I guess it depends on the theorists. I mean, some theorists like to be directed by experiment whenever experiment provides data worth believing. So in this case, but I think the thing, you're absolutely right, David, but the important thing here is you have to not just know something, you have to know everything.
Here you're not asking about a controlled experiment, you're asking about the future.
Yeah, no, exactly. But you have to know everything. Namely, you have to know every possible source of vacuum energy down to the smallest possible one, which means you really have to know the physics on all scales to be able to answer this question, which is perhaps not surprising if you thought about it originally. But it's in your face now, before we could sort of hide it under the rug. It used to think if we measured the geometry of the universe, we'd know the answer, independent of any microphysics. And I think that's the important lesson.
That's simply a theory-dependent statement.
Huh?
Before we thought that if we measured it based on the theory that we thought was reasonable, then we could predict it.
Well, actually, we always knew it. We just never stressed the fact because we didn't talk about it. It's not as if this is some new discovery. It's something that everyone recognized, but everyone discounted the vacuum energy density. So that was implicit in the theory. We just swept it under the rug.
So why did they decide now to emphasize this?
Because we observe it.
Yeah, but you observed something, and you said that no matter what we observe, we are never sure.
It looks like a vacuum energy density, so we suddenly have to think about it.
Yeah,
we used to not.
People have this negative attitude even 100 years ago. When Einstein came out, people have said, there's maybe a vacuum energy density, and they'll never be able to observe it, and then what's the point of doing anything? So why did this change the point of view now?
Because the vacuum energy is observable, apparently, or something that behaves like it, and if it's there, it's going to dramatically affect the future. So if you don't have anything else to do, like me, then you worry about it. Okay.
The point is that the equations are the same equations of general relativity. It's just that there were always too many undetermined functions.
Yeah.
You thought you knew how to determine the function by relating pressure to energy density, and you used normal equations of state. Now we realize that there are possibilities of other kinds of scalar fields, gases, materials that might have different equations of state. And the equations of general relativity aren't enough.
And exactly, that's the point. Before we used to discount those exotic things because we had no evidence that they existed. Now there's evidence that something exists is pretty weird, and we better consider all the possibilities. Thanks, Kerry. Okay, so, but that at least gives us hope because we can't prove that we're living in this universe and where everything will disappear. It could be that everything will reappear before our eyes if we wait long enough. The problem is we can't wait long enough, and so this is the last part of the talk. So my final philosopher is W. Allen, who says, and this is, I know this is in front of your door, in fact, David, but eternity is a long time, especially near the end, as will become obvious during this lecture. Okay, so what I'm going to argue here, I'm going to make a claim, I'm going to try and keep it physics, okay? The claim is that life, which is consciousness, which is not some sort of Wigner-esque type of thing, but something you can really define in a way that I'll define, cannot persist forever in any eternally expanding universe, regardless of what it does. Since we don't know what it's going to do, this is useful. Independent of our cosmological uncertainty, we can prove that life is doomed. Okay, that's the point.
So K equals lambda equals zero, universe also
lambda. Everything. Any universe you can expands forever, life is doomed. You could argue that if the universe recollapses, life isn't doomed. I haven't considered that case, but it seems to me that going through the singularity is probably not a good thing for life. But you know,
this contradicts what Dyson is.
Oh, exactly. I'm going to talk about why Dyson is wrong. Well, I'm going to talk about the debate, because Dyson himself has not yet recognized that he's wrong. So this is what I'm going to tell you about is a debate that's now ongoing, and it's a very enjoyable debate, at least for me. So, in fact, it's based on work that's done with Glenn Starkman, and that we're having the debate with Freeman. So, first of all, there is a fact if you read his paper, he actually implicitly recognized it, but he never proved it. And that is a really unintuitive fact, that there exists only a finite recoverable energy within the horizon for any eternally expanding universe. It's obvious if the universe has a cosmological constant. If a cosmological constant, there's a finite horizon, you obviously can't get anything beyond that. Okay? You would think in all other universes where the horizon grows with time, and the longer you wait, the more you see, the more access of energy you have. The answer is, that's not true. Why is that not true? Well, the only way I know of to show it is to say that will convince you, and this is part of the purpose of this talk, is to say, try it. Imagine a way that you could try and collect energy. The problem is, the energy density in the universe is redshifting faster than you can collect it. Okay? And so you can imagine different ways to do it, and in fact, if you read the long paper that Glenn and I wrote on this subject, we try and go through this in quantitative detail, but let me just give you some examples. Say you want to get energy. You've got a civilization that's, you realize is doomed, and you want to start prospecting for energy. Well, there's two ways. You can prospect for matter, or you can prospect for radiation. What's the best way to prospect for matter? Well, the only way to prospect for matter on large scales is to use gravity. So that's the only long-range force you can have to drag things in. Okay? Now, if there was a net magnetic field in the universe, okay, which was larger than the gravitational field in the universe, so things could collapse, then you might be able to do it. But again, because of the 1 over r squared nature, I'm not sure you would. We could talk about that. But you'd have to dominate over gravity on large scales. And right now, as far as we can tell, on large scales, everything's dominated by gravity. We look out, and we see the Hubble expansion. We don't see large regions contracting with large magnetic fields, but... But you have to know already that there are enough magnetic monopoles to dominate that collapse, to cause that region to collapse. No evidence of that on scales we can see. But there are things we can say about gravity, and here's where the little bit of cosmology comes in. We know, it's a well-known theorem, in fact, that gravity loses against expansion for all universes except a K equals zero flat universe. It's the same as the statement that structure stops forming. In a universe dominated by curvature, or a cosmological constant, structure stops forming on sufficiently large scales. Gravity loses out. And so, in that case, you can't use gravity on a larger than a certain scale. You can't use gravity to collapse things. The only out is the universe we used to think we lived in, a K equals zero flat matter-dominated universe. In that universe, what's called hierarchical structure continues to form on all scales. The larger you get, gravity still works on all scales. There's a nice fine-tuning for an exactly matter-dominated flat universe, and only for that universe. But I would argue in that universe, it's even worse. And the point is, it really depends upon what structures do on very large scales as they come inside the horizon. So how big are fluctuations on large scales on the horizon size if the horizon keeps growing? Well, if they go to zero, then you can't. Then there's no gravitational collapse. But let's say they remain constant, as you might predict from inflation. Okay? The problem with this is that this is an expectation value. This is a quantum phenomenon, statistical. So that delta rho over rho has a variance. The mean size of fluctuations coming inside the horizon is a number, but every now and then larger fluctuations come in because it comes from quantum fluctuations. That means if you wait long enough, you're guaranteed If it's a Gaussian distribution, as quantum mechanics predicts, you're guaranteed that a fluctuation larger than 1 will come inside the horizon, inside of which you are. And then the laws of quantum general relativity tell us that that will collapse into a black hole. And so then if you weight the future of the universe in such a flat matter dummy universe, is you are, if quantum fluctuations have this constant form, is that you're guaranteed eventually to live inside of a black hole, in which case you're dead, eventually. So even in that universe, you can't survive forever.
Well, unless you do something
without that. But if delta rho is greater than 1 on a scale larger than the horizon, then it's pretty hard to imagine any causal way to do something. We'll get to the end, to the non-causal ways around this, okay? To use a quantum gravity. Let me get to life. I'm going to define it. Okay. In fact, let me skip prospecting for radiation, which involves black holes, because it doesn't work either. But it's okay, because Bison gave us the solution. He already said this is a problem. Doesn't matter. You can live forever. You can live forever on finite energy. That was the content of his 1979 beautiful paper. I won't go into this. This other aside is interesting, and Glenn and I are actually working on this now, but it's not quite relevant. So let me give you Dyson's argument from 1979 as refined in 1999 following our work, because he really refined it in a beautiful way to try and lay out exactly what the differences are. So in 1979, Dyson assumed here that life is consciousness, and consciousness means computing. Okay, he would assume that we're nothing but computers. Now, we may be more than computers, but it seems a minimal assumption. And he also said, and you know, I'm contractually obliged to have Star Trek in every talk, but he said, let's assume that life is independent of any specific metabolism. In fact, like Star Trek. In Star Trek, there's always a civilization which runs out of energy, you know, and they put all of their knowledge in a computer, you know, and then Kirk comes and turns it off or something like that. But the point is that as life gets starved of energy, we don't need to be 100-watt heaters. We'll define some intelligent computer chips that will burn much less power, and they'll determine some other really intelligent computer chips that are only made of electrons and positrons after protons decay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So we're going to forget about all of the impediments to life of the sort we know of and just assume the best. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. And then the final thing he did is to say, okay, what does it mean to live forever? He said, what it means to live forever, define subjective time for any civilization, not for an individual, but for a civilization, is to have an infinite total number of thoughts. If the civilization can have an infinite total number of thoughts, then it will, by definition, live forever. Okay? So this is his definition. It's the minimalist version, and he argued that such a future was possible. Okay. What? Yeah, but perhaps, yeah. I mean, exactly. In fact, I'll define exactly what you mean by our lifespan. In fact, here's what he is. So he defined two key facts. The free energy used to process information is proportional to the information and also to the system's temperature. The rate, he defined a quantity which he called the quality of life, the rate of information processing, which he argued was 10 to the 23 bits per second, which is the amount of information processed in order to say, cogito ergo sum. Okay? I think, therefore, I am. So if you can process this information, then you're in a reasonable time, then you're a conscious human being, or a conscious living thing. Now, the point is, we don't know what it takes. Oh, he just plugged in what human beings burn and what they, you know, but the point is, it doesn't matter what the number is. We don't know what the number is. But we all agree, there's a minimal number below which you're not conscious. Okay? A single spin. 2 degrees from you, not likely to be conscious. Okay? So there's some number between 0 and 10 to the 23, below which you're George Bush, and above this which you're conscious. Okay? Okay. So, can I diverge? So the question you can ask, you can put his question quite simply. Can the information process diverge, but the free energy converge? Because if that's the case, you can have an infinite number of thoughts with a finite amount of energy. And that's a simple mathematical question which he can answer, yes. The free energy is the integral of this, which is the temperature times the rate of information processing. The information process, however, is just the integral of Q of T. Therefore, if T goes to zero while Q of T remains non-zero, if life forms cool, then you could imagine this, in fact. But, as Dyson himself proved, Life forms cannot cool fast enough. In fact, at best, you can show in spanning universe the temperature of life forms can go as 1 over time, but really, if you think that systems just cool by radiating, then the rate at which they cool goes like 1/3 of power of time. And if that's the case, you can show that this converges and that diverges only if Q of t goes like t to the n, where n is between 2 and 3. But if Q of t goes like t to this positive power, if the universe cools, eventually Q falls below some critical value and you lose consciousness. So the only way for a system to if it's cooling, to continue to process information is eventually to become unconscious.
Let's go back to your assumption that while you only live forever, you have an infinite number of...
You can define a much more rigorous assumption, but I would agree with Dyson that this is the most conservative possible definition of living forever.
Why? You can simply slow down the rate of thought.
Here we go. Right. Well, you're right along with Dyson. Because okay. So, he said, in fact, the solution is to sleep a long time. Okay? Hibernation. He said, in fact, he actually argued that if you did that, you could have an infinite number of thoughts. Okay? You didn't even have to worry about this. You could actually have an infinite number of thoughts. If Q is constant while you're active and zero while you're inactive, and it's sort of like physicists, if the period of inactivity increases as the universe expands, then you're fine. In fact, if you do the mathematics, you can say, if the length of inactivity increases as the fourth power of time or greater, so you sleep for longer and longer periods, then you can show that F converges and I diverges. In fact, the fraction of time you're awake is a smaller and smaller fraction of the age of the universe. Again, like physicists as they get older. But the subjective time, the total number of thoughts, actually increases as a positive power of time. So you're asleep for longer and longer periods, but the total number of thoughts you have is still infinite. So this was...
The total amount of time you're awake is still roughly.
Yes, but the total energy used during that time, if you can achieve these two things, is finite. Okay? Remarkable. So everything comes down to this big question. Can you sleep? Okay? Well, not to you in particular, but... So there are two answers to this question. And so Glenn and I say no, and Freeman says yes. Okay. If Freeman has already acknowledged that he's an eternal optimist, he wants things to us to live forever. Okay, and he's now got much more, as I said Monday, much more money to based on that. What? In this case, I'm not a pessimist, but I'm just willing to take what nature gives me. Okay. And I will, as you know, and the Templeton Foundation and I, as a result, have parted ways. Okay. The remarkable thing, and the reason I think this is kind of fun, is that the end conclusion depends upon something you would never imagine it would depend upon, which is life quantum mechanical? That's why this is physics and not biology or metaphysics, it seems to me. Now, so here's the argument. So when Glenn and I were arguing with Dyson, it reminds me when I was a student. Steve Weinberg told me that you know there's a famous theorem, Goldstone's theorem in particle physics, which is a nice paper where they proved it. And if you read that paper, there are three proofs of Goldstone's theorem in the paper. And Steve said, well, the reason there were three proofs is because he didn't believe any of them. Okay, when you don't believe any proof, you provide always more than one. In which case, in fact, they were all wrong because you could get around it by the Higgs mechanism. But in this case, we couldn't initially come up with what we thought was a general proof, so we came up with a lot of arguments which we felt would show that you couldn't hibernate. And so I want to show those three of those arguments to you here now. First of all, we argued that okay, you're going to hibernate, but you got to wake up. If you're going to wake up, you need an alarm clock, and an alarm clock requires energy. If you want an infinite number of wake-ups, you get an infinite amount of energy. Just wait. You know, don't worry. I know you're way ahead of me, Phil, but just wait. Okay. The other thing we argued is, in fact, that living systems, we can prove, will fall out of thermal equilibrium with the background radiation, and therefore they can't cool sufficiently fast. Okay. Finally, we said, alarm clocks will fail. Ultimately, they'll fail mechanically, or at the very least, wait long enough, they'll quantum mechanically tunnel out of existence. Okay? And I have a teenage daughter, and I can attest that if her alarm clock does not go off, she will sleep forever. So the point is that civilization we thought these are great arguments. Freeman can't possibly get around them. But of course, Freeman is a sharp cookie, and he came up with arguments against each one. Let me just show you one of these arguments to show you the nature of this. Here's how he got around. Here's how he manifested what Phil was shaking his head about. with a beautiful thing. He said, here's an alarm clock that doesn't require an infinite amount of energy. Take a planet and take two objects orbiting it, okay? And then you design it so the two objects orbit for some amount of time. They'll collide, if you determine their orbital parameters right, and they'll eventually, when they collide, it'll wake you up. Then you move around a little bit. You can arrange for that system to take arbitrary long time before those two things collide with a finite amount of energy. You can take it as long as you want, okay? So there you go. The problem is we showed that that wouldn't work, and it wouldn't work because of quantum mechanics, okay? Eventually, if you want to make them collide in 10 trillion years, you've got to design the momentum exactly right, but quantum mechanics tells you can't determine their momentum exactly right, so eventually you're going to miss. I'm assuming h bar is constant. You're absolutely right. You're right. I'm assuming No. You know, you're like Freeman's sidekick in a way. It's perfect because if h bar isn't constant, then the world becomes classical. And we'll argue the only way out is for the world to become classical. Okay. So this kind of debate went back and forth for a long time, but then we came up with an argument which seemed irrefutable. We thought. So. We said at some level life is quantum mechanical. At some level, the fundamental physics governing life and intelligence and computation is quantum mechanical. Now, that might seem really good because one of the recognitions, although it was actually true for classical systems too, but it was first recognized in the context of quantum computing, I believe, that a fundamental theorem that we used to think to be true, that it would take a finite amount, we dissipate a finite amount of energy and entropy in every computation, is not true. You can do reversible, completely reversible computations, and quantum mechanically it's easiest to show it. You can design a quantum computer that does a completely reversible computation. Okay? So this theorem that we used to think about KT not equals zero for computations is just not true. So in principle, you can do an infinite number of computations on a finite energy and entropy. The problem is, it turns out that where you dissipate entropy and energy is in erasing the registers and starting a new computation. So, you can stare at your belly button for eternity, thinking the same thought over and over again, and you're fine. You can live forever by that context. Okay? If you want to have the same thought an infinite number of times, no problem. But if you want to have a new thought, okay, if you want to erase the registers and do a new computation, then you dissipate this, and then you're dead. Because all systems are ultimately quantum mechanical, and any finite size quantum mechanical system has the following property, that there are no accumulation points at the ground state. Below a certain energy level, there are always a finite number of states for any finite quantum mechanical system. So, if every time you do a thought or a series of thoughts, you then erase the registers and do a new thought, your system has to go down a state. Then it goes down again, then it goes down again, goes down again, and eventually you get to the ground state where you're not thinking. This seemed to be an irrefutable argument that if things depend upon quantum mechanics, you cannot, don't shake your head so because Dyson's way ahead of you.
You're assuming K is
constant. Okay. What? You can have a flat, you can have it at the above the ground state, that's true, but of course we don't live in a supersymmetric universe. You will agree. Okay. In a finite super, no, but not in a finite system. In a supersymmetric system, you get a flat directions of arbitrary close to zero, but you've got to have an infinite volume. It doesn't violate that fundamental principle of quantum mechanics. So if you have a finite system, it's bound. It's still bound at supersymmetry, I think. Okay, excellent. Good. Well, we'll put that in my, you'll see my caveats at the end where you can, ways you can get around this in case you're incredibly depressed.
I have comments from condensed matter side as to this point. That we know of some condensed matter system, this frustration for instance, in which number of states accumulates and grows infinitely up going to lower states. So it's not necessarily that they are kind of equidistant.
Not for finite size systems, I think. I think it's pretty clear for finite size systems it's impossible. Yeah. I mean, you can only get this in an infinite system. This is great. Okay. You mean, oh, that's a good question. There's no, you mean, if the universe just metastable and it keeps...
Yeah.
That's a very good point, actually. If there's no ground state, you're absolutely right. I think you're right. But the question is, at what point will the universe then tunnel to, I mean, if there's no, I mean, the big problem with no universes with no ground state is that you want the state you're in to be metastable. Because the minute the vacuum state of the universe changes, it's unlikely that any life that existed before will exist afterwards, since the bound state systems will be different. Okay. But I want to point out that Dyson came out with an argument against this. So you don't have to do all this fancy stuff like supersymmetry. Okay? Because he reads science fiction. And he read Fred Hoyle. And Fred Hoyle wrote a book called The Black Cloud. And The Black Cloud, for those of you who read it, it's a beautiful story. It's about this cloud that's discovered in space with, you know, sort of gaseous cloud, which they eventually realized that, in fact, the motion of the particles in this cloud encodes an intelligence. And Dyson pointed out, here's a system that continues to avoid the quantum mechanical limit. Namely, if you take a cloud of gas, and you just encode it, you encode information in the motion of those particles in the classical phase space, if you let the cloud sort of expand, the temperature goes like 1 over L, the size of it, then you can show that the velocity and momentum will scale this way, and the total classical information content in the phase space is N log L, whereas the quantum information is N. So you have a system that is, as increases in scale, it appears to have more, can encode more and more information in the classical phase space. So he said, here is my way out. Although he pointed out he didn't know of any such system practically which would do this, but in here's a system, and what I mean by this, there's lots of different ways to think about this. This system becomes more and more classical. What you do by avoiding the quantum limit is you press down the density of states. So the density of states decreases fast enough so that at a given temperature, it looks like, you don't worry about the discreteness. Okay? At a given temperature, it doesn't look quantum mechanical. That's what it means to be non-quantum mechanical. The density of states is such that the mean spacing between levels is small compared to the available energy, then the system doesn't look quantum mechanical. So here is his argument. Now, that is where the debate now lies, because we have made arguments for why we don't think that's possible, and I won't go into them here. We started late, but I'd still like to end on time. It turns out we believe for a whole number of reasons the system won't work, and we're currently debating Dyson about whether this particular way out is possible. Okay?
Even though you can have finite number of degrees of freedom, you have to have a thermodynamic limit. You can't be in finite volume, which is a very big issue.
But the system can, the question is, as long as the system expands at a physical rate, you can avoid at any temperature, you can always make the density of states sufficiently large that you can avoid the arguments the arguments that I gave. But we believe that there are many problems, not least of which, as this system becomes more and more diffuse, how does it act like a coherent system that you could wake up and all sorts of other things? But you don't want to worry about that unless you want to worry about that, but you can do that in your own time. What we agree upon, and what Freeman and we agree upon, is this is the question. We agree that if quantum mechanics ultimately governs the future of life in a universe starved of energy, then life must end. So as Dyson has put it, in a particularly poetic way, is life ultimately analog, meaning classical, or digital, quantum mechanical? And the future is only possible if life is analog. So the future is to get back to your record players and give up your compact discs, okay? That's the future. Now, that's why I think this is worth giving as a physics colloquium. Because what amazes me is, in principle, this statement. If quantum mechanics ultimately governs the universe starved of energy, independent of what we don't know about the laws of physics and cosmology and everything else, consciousness must end. And these are questions of physics. As you point out, I didn't define what I meant by life or by biological systems or any of that. I just used basic laws of quantum mechanics and information processing. And that amazes me. If we can really do this, if you could really argue this was true, it seems to me to be a remarkably interesting result. And it may not seem that way to you, but as I say. Now, there are caveats, and there are lots of them. I put some of your caveats, I would put them in this thing. First of all, everything I said depended upon causality, simple things that we take for granted now. But maybe quantum gravity, which after all could do anything until we have a theory of it that works. Maybe there's significant non-causal processes. Maybe you can create wormholes that allow you to connect what would otherwise be causally disconnected regions of a large universe. So there's lots of ways out here. There's also the possibility of baby universes, which don't get out of this problem, but they allow you, if you can't live forever, you can still play God. Okay? Because if you could create a baby universe, you could put a little bit of your intelligence into that baby universe before it collapsed. Baby universes, as you know, are things you probably can't create in the laboratory, but if you could, from the outside they look like a black hole that collapses. From the inside they grow to a causally disconnected region. So you drop a little bit of your intelligence or your DNA or something into there, and you hope that, although you'll never be able to communicate with that universe, that that civilization that results will recognize that if they make a baby universe, they can propagate your intelligence forever. But of course, there are theorems suggesting you can't make baby universes in the laboratory. But as far as I know, there are still no exact proofs of that. It's highly unlikely, but no one can prove it exactly. Now, I thought Katie would be here, so I would say since she's not here, I won't give this one. She's apparently she just showed me a New Scientist article that came out today that says she had avoided this, but I don't think so. But in any case, I thought I would give her credit for being a superhero, because that's what the article said. We wrote a Scientific American piece on this subject, and I got a letter that said to me that I was missing a huge source of energy. And this was it. So I wrote back and said, well, if we're missing this one, there are probably other big sources of energy we're missing. But anyway, the solace of all of this is it's completely irrelevant. I mean, it's really not, it doesn't matter. Because the time scale on which any of this is going to be significant, even for our own galaxy, is of order 10 to the 50th to then 100 years. So it doesn't matter. These limits I'm talking about are not, I mean, we will die long before this due to simpler things. But if we could imagine the most optimistic of all possible worlds, where we avoid all of those simple things, what? Yeah, well, what I mean is, certainly proton decay will probably happen. But if you can get around every one of the catastrophes that the universe is going to throw at us, this is the time scale when you have to worry about these questions. So, my conclusion is this cosmic uncertainty principle, which is, I argued in the first part of the talk that you need an infinite amount of time to determine the ultimate fate of the universe if you depend on experiment. But I argued in the second half of the talk that we only have a finite amount of time left, and therefore, an eternal mystery will remain. And for me, actually, that's the best of all possible worlds. Thank you. Any questions that weren't asked? Phil?
You really didn't answer this question. I suppose a lot of fundamental constants change as the universe expands. And any arguments you made, I don't think hold.
Well, I put that in the context of... If you allow the laws of physics to fundamentally change, and I think, as I say, from my point of view, by allowing the constants of nature to change, you're asking, can you constantly avoid the quantum limit? I mean, it just comes down to that. Can you avoid the quantum limit or not? And I'd throw in changing of fundamental constants as one way of potentially avoiding the quantum mechanical limit. But I think it really is the same question, regardless of whether you allow that or not. I mean, that's the question. Can you either avoid it with a black cloud or some other way, but you've got to avoid the quantum mechanical limit for any finite system, if you want to avoid the arguments that I believe we presented. Yeah?
So, does this constitute a proof of the non-existence of God?
Oh, no, heaven is not a physical thing, so it's okay. I refuse to either prove or disprove the existence of God. I refuse to even think about the question. Because I get along pretty well without it. Any other questions? Okay, good. Okay.